Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is Paul Deepan. He has just published his debut novel, The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Simon.
Maybe we could start with a little biographical information. Who is Paul Deepan?
Well, I was born in Trinidad, and I went to school there. I attended school in England as well, and spent most of my school days in Canada. My parents were, my father was Trinidadian, my mother was English. They met when my dad went over there to do medical school. He came back to Trinidad. We sort of followed him. They ended up not thinking that Trinidad was a great place to raise a family, so we went to Canada. And, boy, let me tell you, moving from Port of Spain, Trinidad, to Ottawa, Canada was a big change. And then I went to university in Canada. I went to University of Toronto, University of Waterloo, University of Western Ontario, mostly life sciences and business administration. I ended up working in the pharmaceutical industry in Hamilton, Ontario, at the teaching hospitals there, and in London, Ontario. And I met my wife, Lori, there. She was a resident in internal medicine at the time. And we got married, and subsequently we moved to the States. We live in Tennessee now, and we've lived here for approximately 16 years. My older son was born in Canada. My younger son was born here. And we've lived in the Nashville area for about the past 6 years.
Well, you mentioned England in that world tour. What part of England were you in?
My mother was from London, but and my dad went to medical school in Newcastle, but we as a family lived in Sheffield. So my sister was born there. My dad was an avid cricket player and fan, and to play cricket for Yorkshire at the time, you had to be born in Yorkshire. So my mom was having some tests done in London. It looked like the baby was going to arrive, and he shipped her back to Sheffield very quickly so that his next child could play cricket for Yorkshire, but his next child was a girl. So it served him right for doing that.
I mean, that's one of the best sports fan stories I think I've heard in a long time.
Yeah.
What led you into the literary field?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I've always been a reader. Ever since I was little, I learned to read at a young age. I loved it. There was never any... in fact, rather than trying to get me to read, my parents used to have to try to get me to stop reading, you know, and go outside and get some sun on my skin, because I would just happily sit and read all day long. When I was about, oh, I guess 8 or 9 years old, I discovered that one of my dad's cousins, V.S. Naipaul, was an author. And so that kind of sparked the idea that it might be fun to write some of these things that I spent so much time reading. And so I used to do, you know, stories in school and all that kind of thing. And growing up, I would always have stories in the yearbooks and, you know, all the rest of it. So it was always something that I was interested in. Becoming a writer was always something that I wanted to do. I didn't know if I wanted to do it full-time, but I certainly had the idea in my brain that I wanted to write a book one day from really as far back as I can remember.
Huh. And, you know, obviously at some point you said, okay, I am going to do this.
Yes.
Without giving away any spoilers, can you tell us a little bit about the story in The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree?
Sure. The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree is the title, The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree, is sort of the pivotal element in the plot of the book. My protagonist, Jake Patel, is 17 years old, and his mom is dying of breast cancer. and he makes a bargain with the universe to save her life. And he says, he not only says that he doesn't care if he has to die, he takes it a step further, and he says, I don't care who has to die. And he has a friend at school whose name is Jenny, and she's a kind of witch. She wants to be a witch. But she's in contact, and actually so is Jake, through his dreams, with a real witch in a different world who transports him there. And the new world is called Tiramond. And when he comes to Tiramond, Jake discovers that if he is successful in taking the fruit of the Dendragon tree and returning it to his mom, he can save her life. But the cost of doing that, so this is now derivative somewhat of The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis.
Right.
Where Diggory Kirk, you know, is there at the inception of Narnia and comes back with the fruit that Aslan gives him, and his mom is, you know, she does very well afterwards. The story, my story is like that, but it's much darker. There is some humor, but it's also much more grown up and darker than The Magician's Nephew. And the stakes are higher because Jake's father, David, goes after him to Tiramond. And the price of picking the fruit in Tiramond is that the dragon Kildrake will be released from his thousand-year confinement, and all sorts of social upheaval will take place if that occurs. So the cost of picking this fruit is very, very high. And at the end of the book, Jake is also forced to decide which of his parents he's going to save, because he's put in a situation where they are both near death, and he must choose which one to save.
You mentioned C.S. Lewis. I have to admit, as a child, I loved C.S. Lewis. I don't know how many times I've read the Narnia series. Obviously, he's a bit of an influence on you and your writing.
Absolutely, no question.
What made you take the fantasy route?
Well, at the risk of, you know, sounding like I'm playing a broken record, that was also an idea I got from Mr. Lewis, because he uses the fantasy genre to explore some fairly important religious and spiritual themes in his work. Out of the Silent Planet, you know, the grown-up series, and then, of course, the Narnia books are, there's very much elements of Christianity and Christian theology in those books. And I come from a background where I've had to reconcile. My father was a Hindu, my mother was Church of England, and so my own personal spiritual journey was part of integrating those different spiritual elements in my own life. And so The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree also explores elements of reincarnation, life, what happens to a person after death, where do we go, you know, what is life kind of about. So the fantasy structure is used to explore some of these themes, and it's a way of doing that without it becoming, you know, terribly preachy or what have you. You can just, at one level, you can just sort of enjoy the story, but on the other level, there's this whole inner dialogue and inner tension around matters of life and death and spirituality.
The book itself does have some very dark themes in it, you know, and when most people think of fantasy, you know, they think of cute little elves and things, but you've taken fantasy on very much an adult journey. I think that's the best way of describing it.
Well, that was certainly my intention. Yes, I wanted to explore, you know. And I guess these stories that meant so much to me growing up, what would they be like, what would they feel like if it wasn't sort of a more childlike or childish approach? What would it be like to face these things really, really as adults and even real teenagers in our own world?
Right. And I think you've done an absolutely fabulous job of achieving that, by the way.
Thank you.
On the... the back cover, I noticed that a portion of the profits are being donated to cancer research. I don't wish to pry into anything personal, but could you tell us a little bit about your reason for doing this?
Oh, sure. I don't mind at all. And in fact, as I explore this a little bit in an afterword at the end of my narrative, called Life Imitating Art. My wife is a breast cancer survivor, and however, she was not diagnosed with that disease until I finished The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree. In my professional life, I actually, in pharmaceuticals, dealt with a couple of agents that were used in breast cancer treatment, and so I just ended up knowing quite a bit about that disease. They educate you very specifically towards disease state in the pharmaceutical industry, and that just happened to be a disease state I came to know a lot about. So it was, a convenient disease to give Jake's mom from just a narrative storytelling point of view. And so I wrote that whole thing through, and then my character Jake, my son's middle name is Jacob, so in a funny kind of way, Jake was named after my son. And Jake was 17 in the story when his mom gets breast cancer. And I finished The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree, at least the first draft, I want to think it was in about 2007, July of 07. In August of 07, when my son was 17, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. So life eerily imitated art in my personal experience. And when I was coming through the process of trying to figure out how to get this book into publication, and I didn't know if you wanted to talk about that now or a bit later, but it's a very difficult process for a new author, and so I decided to self-publish, and I decided that I would donate part of my proceeds to breast cancer research in order to, help bring the book along.
I admire people like yourself. I think it's great that you're giving a portion of the proceeds to cancer research. What sort of reader feedback are you getting?
Well, so far I've been very thrilled with the reader feedback. Many people say very consistent things. I think I have about 7 or 8 reviews on Amazon's page right now. They're all 5-star reviews. I don't know everybody that's put a review there. I mean, some of them, of course, have been people I know who've read the book and liked it. I do have friends that are brutally honest, and if they thought that the book was horrible, they would have told me so. And they have been very, very nice to me about that. I also have people that I don't know at all, and what's fascinating to me is that people are saying pretty much the same sort of things. That although this is a fantasy, it is not the sort of usual run-of-the-mill fantasy. There are the typical elements of, werewolves and centaurs and travel to a distant world and a quest kind of theme for the protagonist, but the quest has a sort of different twist to it, and the plot narrative is a vehicle for some, very different and more profound questioning around spiritual themes. And everybody's kind of getting that. It apparently, does show through, which is great, because that's what I intended to have happen. I really wrote this book for people who wouldn't ordinarily read fantasy. It has all the elements in it to satisfy the person who would normally read in that genre, but it's also intended for people who wouldn't normally read there. And much of the reader feedback does come from people who don't normally read fantasy and who do feel it's an important book for them to have read, and they're glad that they stepped outside of their sort of readership comfort zone to read a fantasy novel.
Where the all-important commercial part of this interview, where can people buy The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree?
Thank you for asking. Right now, I am selling strictly online for people outside of the sort of, Nashville, Tennessee area. I am beginning to market to local independent booksellers here, but for a wider audience, it's on Amazon.com and on BarnesandNoble.com. And I will very shortly also be offering the book for sale through my own website, because what I've realized, I've done a few book signings, and my book retails for $14.95, and at these book signings, I was also co-marketing or co-promoting for certain charities. So I would go and say to a charity, look, I'm already giving a certain portion of my proceeds to breast cancer research, but I like what you guys are doing too. And if you'd like me to come to your fundraising event and do a book signing, you know, anything over and above what I need to earn to cover my cost of ordering my own books and giving a certain part of my proceeds to breast cancer, I'll be happy to give to you. And it's been great because these folks are like, sure, come on down. And so I've raised money for myself and for breast cancer and for their charities also by doing this kind of work. Wow. But it occurred to me that I need to be able to make the book commercially available on my own website also, so that people can phone in and, you know, order online. And when they place their order, my plan is to have different promotional codes, so that if there's a particular area where they'd like their donation to go, you know, they can just sort of identify it by promotional code, and I'll forward the funds along to that nonprofit.
You've mentioned that you have a website. What is the URL for it?
It's dead easy to remember. It's www.pauldeepin.com. It's my first and last name all run together. Deepin is spelled D-E-E-P-A-N, so it's pauldeepin.com.
The story in the book operates on some different levels. There's the obvious, you know, good versus evil thread, but there's also this dark, if you will, personal conflict between father and son. Where did the idea for the father-son conflict come from?
You know, that's a really interesting question. It's not at all like the relationship I had with my dad. My dad and I were very close. So it doesn't come from there. But, you know, it's really interesting to me to kind of revisit some of this, because I started writing the book, you know, putting my notes together. I mean, it's been a long time now. It's been a very long gestation for this particular book. But several months after my dad died. And I think that at least part of the narrative has to be informed by the fact that when you're a man, or, you know, a boy, and you lose your father, you pretty much lose the man who loves you more than anybody else in the world. And so I think that was the element I wanted to explore. And, you know, conflicts drive story, so I put their relationship into more of a conflict mode than my own personal relationship with my dad was. But also, you know, a lot of my friends growing up and as adults, they've had this issue with their dad where there's clearly a great amount of love in the relationship, but the ability to communicate those feelings, you know, may be somewhat mitigated either by the father's emotional state because of, you know, generational issues, you know, like we just don't show that sort of thing, or by the sons, you know, wanting to sort of be tougher than they really are, and so they're not going to soften up and show their dad how they really feel. So it's just a very, very fertile and interesting, you know, relationship to explore. But I also found myself exploring the relationship between mothers and daughters, and, you know, mothers and sons, and fathers and daughters. All of those relationships are explored to one level or another in the book as we go forward. So it's that whole sort of family of origin relationship structure is something I very much wanted to talk about in the book.
Often authors base their characters on real people, maybe not one single identifiable person, but rather bits and pieces, the traits of of several people and they meld them into a character. Is that the approach you took with your characters?
Not consciously. I think if I based anybody on anybody, I used elements of my own persona to inform my characters. I didn't consciously sort of go, well, this character reminds me of so-and-so, and that so-and-so would be someone in my real life. That didn't happen, at least on a conscious level. What was very fascinating to me is that there were elements of myself in all of my characters, including the ones that aren't terribly nice characters. So it was the whole exploration of, you know, what Carl Jung called the shadow side. Some of those characters represent elements of my own shadow persona, and it's a very cool way of bringing them to life in a totally risk-free environment, you know, where you're not actually out committing crimes or being evil in the world. You can just sort of bring those elements of yourself that you kind of keep in the basement most of the time, that you can give them life on the page. And that was a really fun exercise to do.
Being evil vicariously.
Yeah, you know, it's like actors who get to play these evil roles. I mean, I've done a little bit of amateur stage work, and the bad characters are always so much fun to play. And you can draw upon those elements, like I said, of yourself that you never show visibly in the public world to inform that interpretation. And the same thing happened here. I mean, Kilbrae is really bad, the dragon, but he's also quite funny. And I just loved writing him because that was really me. It's the part of me that I never show the world.
Yes. Kildrake does have his moments, that's for certain. What is next for you? Are we going to see a sequel, or are you planning on heading in a completely different direction?
No, there definitely should be a sequel to Fruit of the Ben Dragon Tree. There were the whole Jenny Blackwood, who's the witch in this world, her character arc is not yet complete, and the sequel will describe a lot about what happens to her and how she and Jake get a chance to meet up again and what happens. There are elements of prophecy that remain unfulfilled at the end of the Fruit of the Ben Dragon Tree that needs to sort of be moved forward. And so that will justify writing the second book, which will be called The King of Tiramon. The other piece of it, I suppose it would be called a prequel, which is some of the family of origin stuff, and some of the interesting interactions that my own family has had with black magic in this world, and how that kind of sets the stage for the whole ability of these people in this family to access, you know, a completely different parallel world.
Right. Have you actually started putting pen to paper, or is it still just in the planning phase?
I have started writing The King of Tiramon, and it is also in the planning stage. it's sort of a parallel activity. You change what you think is going to happen. The most interesting part for me in writing is whose perspective am I going to tell this piece of the story from? And that's always the most challenging bit for me. It's also the most interesting bit, whether it's going to be from Jake's perspective or his dad's perspective or Jenny's perspective or whoever. You know, that just makes it all the more fun to try to write it.
Do you have a guesstimate on when this new book is likely to hit the market?
You know, I'd like it to be within the next year, year and a half. I mean, well, that's another element of the feedback I'm getting is I really don't want to wait a whole long time for this sequel. This was a very good book, and I want to know what happens to these characters. That's also a fairly uniform piece of feedback that I'm getting. So, obviously, when you risk putting a book out there on the marketplace, you kind of mentally gear yourself up for the fact that, well, you know, maybe nobody's going to like this book except for you, which tells you something about you. But the other thing I think that you need to be prepared for is if other people really do like it and they want more. And that is something that I'm getting. And so I feel I have a duty to kind of pay attention to that. So I'd like to have something, you know, maybe by the end of 2011, beginning of 2012.
How long did it take you to bring the fruit of the Dendragon tree to completion?
Well, you know, when I first started really sitting down and doing it seriously, I would say it took me about a year to a year and a half. But there was so much conceptual gestation that went on before that. I first named the characters and the main characters and sort of had an idea of, you know, I'd like to write something like The Magician's Nephew, only more grown up. I'd like to write a fantasy like Narnia, but more grown up. I'd like to write something like that where the stakes were a lot higher than what we see in some of those other books. And it wasn't just the Narnia books. There's also elements of influence from The Lord of the Rings and from T.H. White, who wrote The Once and Future King. And all of that stuff probably happened about began to happen as long ago as 12 years before the book actually, you know, came into its final packaged version. So it's really difficult to say how long I spent writing it, quote unquote, because the other thing that happens, of course, is even when you're not sitting down in front of your computer or on your at your desk writing madly, you know, with your notes, when you're walking around in the world, you're thinking about what's happening to your characters, and you very often have this dazed look in your eyes that people who know you kind of go, oh, he's writing again, even though you're not actually writing. You're just not really paying attention.
Many authors find the publishing phase to be incredibly frustrating, you know, finding a publisher. You know, do you self-publish? Do you take the traditional route? Do you need an agent? What was your experience? Did you find it a frustrating part of the whole process?
Very much so, and I was warned by this. I had a very good editor, and I'll give him a little plug too. His name's Pat Lobrutto, L-O-B-R-U-T-T-O. And Pat has a ton of experience in the Orthodox publishing world and now works as a sort of, you know, book editor as a private consultant. And he really helped me bring this book, you know, to a what he called a marketable or saleable, you know, conclusion. And he also used his network of contacts in the industry to affect introductions for me with agents. So I'd go to a writer's conference and I'd say, you know, Pat Lobrutto read this book and he thinks I should show it to you. And they would go, oh, great. Well, if it's Pat, you know, absolutely, send it along. And so that was really good. That was, you know, a step forward for most people, because most people have to do it, you know, through their own devices and try to convince these folks to pay attention to them and what have you. I would recommend that anybody goes to writers' conferences that agents and editors attend, whether or not they're thinking of self-publishing. You know, they just need to meet those folks and get a sense. And what I was uniformly hearing was that the market was very congested. The power was really transferring to the large, big-volume discount retailers like Walmart and Barnes & Noble. They have a lot of power in the channel. The decisions around what was going to be published, made by publishing companies, were happening more and more by committee, with much more of a view to what has been commercially successful in the most recent past. And fewer and fewer people are able to take an entrepreneurial leap of faith within a publishing house to represent a new author and say, look, I really think we need to publish this guy, and, you know, have the ability to do that, have the power to do that in-house. The agents that I approached uniformly gave me great feedback. A couple of them early on were responsible for me affecting, I think, some very positive changes to the narrative. And then subsequent to that, I had feedback that went, I mean, I remember my last one distinctly, and this was about the seventh or eighth agent that I approached. And it sort of went like this. This is a very good book. It's a very saleable book. It's definitely deserving of publication. However, I have committed to represent two first-time authors of fantasy whose work I cannot sell. So the catch-22 is, if you're a first-time author, you need an agent, but even if you secure an agent, you're not necessarily going to get published. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm not willing to wait this out. And so I decided to go the self-publishing route. I think the reason that I didn't immediately do that was because, you know, historically there has been somewhat of a stigma, you know, if you publish yourself, it means that nobody wants to publish you. But I think nowadays that's becoming less and less true. I think with the advent of on-demand publishing and online marketing, really the market will speak for itself. The market will decide what has value and what doesn't. And although the bar has been lowered so that sort of almost anyone can publish, not everyone will be successful publishing because the quality of the work will really decide who gets read.
You mentioned your editor. I read a lot of books, and some people think that they can do their own editing, and inevitably they fall flat on their face. But even if you do have an editor, it's not always a pleasant experience, you know, having someone else hack your work around. How did you feel about someone coming in and changing your work?
I think for myself, I believe that I was willing to do whatever was going to make this book be the best book I could make it. And if someone was going to give me feedback that I might not necessarily want to hear, but if I was able to put my own ego aside and look at it objectively, and I think that is a very positive character attribute that I have. You have to be able to do that. You have to be able to put your ego aside and look at your work and say, is this commentary going to make this better? And the other thing is, you know, I did have a professional relationship with an editor, but I also, there were a couple of other people that were reading the manuscript, and if they all sort of start to say the same things, you might want to pay attention. Now, one of the things that Pat and I violently disagreed about was when Jake finds himself in Tiramond, Pat never thought that I did a sufficient job of having Jake feel dislocated and disoriented by having traveled there. And I thought that, you know, I've done enough to show that Jake is, you know, kind of freaking out that he's now in a different world and how did I get here and all the rest of it. And I just said, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we just sort of came to terms with it is my book, it is my vision, and I kept it the way it was. And interestingly, no one has said to me who's read it, you know, Jake doesn't really seem freaked out enough. So from that perspective, I feel that, you know, I did a reasonable job with that. But I also didn't want to make him into a wimp. He's not a wimpy kid. He's a very strong-willed, very passionate boy. And, yeah, he's going to be dislocated, as anyone would be, but he's also going to adapt and move forward because he's there for a reason.
Right. Are you yourself much of a reader? And if you are, who are your favorite authors?
You know, yes, I've spent a lot of my life reading. One of the things that I've noticed as I've become a writer is that reading almost became a reason not to actually be writing, because it was much easier. It's hard work to write. And so often the time that I would carve out of my schedule, you know, to have time to write, I would sometimes fill it with reading instead. So I read less now that I'm writing than I used to. But certainly historically, I mean, I would read a phone book if it was the only thing that was around. I tend to read, interestingly enough, I don't read a lot of fantasy, but some of my favorite books that I've ever read have been fantasy, which is curious to me. I love English murder mysteries, and I love most stuff by, I'd say English authors are typically where I go. I love Dick Francis, for instance. I love Elizabeth George, who's actually American, but she writes, you know, about all of her novels are set in England, and the whole Inspector Linley series, you know, they're very English, and she does a magnificent job of doing that. But my favorite books are the Narnia series, are the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, and are the Once and Future King by T.H. White. So, you know, that's very interesting to me. Even though I don't read a lot of other fantasy, I also like Ursula K. Le Guin a tremendous amount, although I came to her later in life. She's another author who really explores some very, very interesting spiritual themes in her fantasy work.
You mentioned Dick Francis. I enjoy Dick Francis' work as well. Although I am a little bit cynical, I guess. You know, the average Dick Francis book involves the hero getting beaten up twice.
Yeah. They did sort of become the Dick Francis formula almost. I'm like, well, he hasn't been beaten up yet, so that's going to happen soon.
Right.
I did respect the fact that he was able to write in the first person with so many different voices. I mean, his characters are, you know, not the same from book to book. And given how prolific he was, I thought that that was a very, you know, good compliment to him as an author. He also writes about the English racing scene, which I am completely unfamiliar with at a personal level, and it was just a fascinating world. So I liked him taking his readers into that world. It was just very interesting to read.
Yeah, I've always found him to be a very enjoyable author. You know, it doesn't require a huge amount of brain power to follow the plot. You know, you just ride along with it. You mentioned a bit earlier on that you have been doing some book signings. Is that your prime marketing vehicle at the moment?
Well, it's certainly one of them locally, and I suppose it will evolve into something regionally. I'm also trying to get, you know, there's a few university students that are reading the book that like it. They're involved in creative writing studies in their programs at school. They have a lot of friends who read. Have a lot of friends who read fantasy. I'm trying to get some energy around that. If they, you know, if they like the book, will they use their social networks such as Facebook and, you know, just their own interpersonal friendships to try to talk the book up? I may be able to get into some of their reader groups, you know, at various colleges around the country as well. So I'm looking at all sorts of different and creative ways. I'm exploring, as I said, co-promotion activities with various charities. If they want to take advantage of what I'm doing, October is coming up. That's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. There's quite a few charities here in town that will be ramping up some fundraising efforts for that. So I'm hoping to get, you know, on board with a couple of those as well. So we'll see. The really nice thing about self-publishing is that you're your own publisher. So, you know, and your book never goes out of print as long as you want it to be in print. So it's not like you have this tremendous urgency to get things done immediately, which is another good thing. And so you can more slowly and methodically build a clientele and a loyal clientele, I think, than you might be able to do if you were a first-time author with an orthodox publishing arrangement.
Paul, alas, our time is at an end, but I really want to thank you for talking with us today, and I know I speak for everyone here at Blogger News. Wishing you every success with the fruit of the Den Dragon Tree.
Thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate the chance of having spoken with you.
Okay, well, hopefully we can talk again at some point in the future.
Let's hope so.
Okay, till next time. Thank you, Paul, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.